Once again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I think as we've seen more and more of the rhetoric around the increases in gun violence being a result of defund movements or being calls to increase policing in communities, it seemed like you and the work that your organization does were great voices to listen to in terms of how to think about that differently and how to think about different solutions. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today, and hopefully that seems like a good outline for discussion.
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, you know, my nephew was killed in gun violence, and that's what led to my organizing and activism. And they never investigated. We don't know who did it. And, you know, obviously there's a lot more of that happening in our community. So I'm glad that I get to speak to this, because I do still believe in defunding the police and abolition of these systems that oppress us. And I don't think that funding them or hiring more officers is a solution that's worked for us in the past, or I don't even see how they could project that it would ever work for us in the future. So, yeah, thank you for giving me space.
So we know that, like, the city and the police bureau and, of course, the police union, and then other private citizens sort of represented by groups like Portland or People for Portland and the Portland Business Alliance, they all have their own framing of this increase in gun violence, which, again, the statistics that we're looking at do come from PPB also. We just want to call that out. We're curious, how do you and Don't Shoot Portland frame what we're seeing happening in the city around gun violence right now?
I mean, we've always had issues with gun violence in America, period. America, more than any other country in the world, we coddle our weapons, right? And I think we also coddle racism, but we've never found it valuable to invest in poverty, to, you know, develop opportunities for people that are affected by gun violence. A lot of times they say, you know, that, you know, these are disadvantaged and marginalized and at-risk communities. And they'll say that when the children are being born, before they're even in education, schools, or any sort of social environments. And it's like they're predicting that there's going to be a failure or a loss of life. And that's why they tag them with at-risk or whatever. And so it's very insidious that with all of that language around who we are before we even have an access point to social access, that they've already said we're going to die or go to jail. You know, we lead numbers in unaliving ourselves in depression and being unhoused and, you know, being undereducated, overrepresented in jails and systems. You know, our unhoused community, when we did our audits back in 2018, we saw that, you know, a lot of the children that were unhoused were coming out of foster care, and that people that were unhoused were coming back into society from being incarcerated, whether, you know, it was violent reasons that they were there or not. But the mandates put on Black people in the state of Oregon have been to not return to your community because you are deemed a risk of harm. Redlining went past the 40s and the 60s. And well into the 80s and 90s in regards to where we could be, where our bodies were allowed to be in the city. And so in my own opinion, and witnessing the psychological terror that, you know, happens to people that are treated that way in a free society and treated that way while people are silent, you know, people that engage with them in life are silent, and seeing the regulation of people, of course there's going to be violence. Of course there's going to be self-unaliving. Of course there's going to be domesticated responses to situations. But there is zero investment in those communities. And I say that because even this week, I think there was an announcement that there's like $600,000 that's going to go to five different organizations to fight gun violence. And I'm like, how disgusting that we would put $600,000 into the hands of five different organizations to split, and their job is to stop the violence. And then the federal government's response is that, and yes, we're gonna put more there. Well, you've tried that, you've done that for 30 years. And when we look at how the effects of the 1984 or 86 crime bill the 1994 crime bill, you know, how it created an opportunity for community policing partners and creating the mass incarceration as we see it today. And it wasn't an investment. It wasn't an investment in housing or education or jobs. It was just like an investment in locking up these super predators. I mean, come on, where else would we be with that type of insidious planning? And how silent can we be in society where we know that our children and our families could never be treated like that if we're not Black? You know, there's a lot of anti-Blackness that satisfies these opportunities of treating Black people as if they've created a problem before they even had access. And to me, as a Black person that actually knows my history, it's like this retaliation for not being enslaved anymore. It's the only solution for dealing with people that you don't want to have liberty in this country. And that breeds violence.
And one thing that stuck out to me from what you said was that there's this sort of like this lie that's being told that when we that investment in communities can look like policing, that investment in communities can look like, you know, quote unquote, public safety. And I think, you know, what you're saying, what really stands out to me is that that investment has always been, the investment framed that way has always been a lie, because it's always been underlaid with this foundation of racism and as you're saying, it sounds like vengeance. And I'm wondering from your perspective, like what would a genuine investment in Black communities and brown communities in Portland look like from your perspective?
Reparations. And I'm not talking about when we ask our allies to develop mutual aid systems to support people that are more vulnerable. I'm talking about state sanctioned reparations, because they know that they've mobilized. When I look at like the history of Oregon and I see what like Klan King, what's his name? Klan Kegel and some of these other, you know, Oregonians from before I was born, how they kind of instituted social services and real estate and charitable processes in order to kind of invigorate a whole financial system to deal with the Black people, to deal with the Negro removal problem. When I see that we're still kind of benefiting and building on those type of sources, there was never a clear plan to create an inclusion for us. It was always to identify us. And I mean, like last year we did a Liberated Archives installation, and there was this petition that we used as vinyl wallpaper to kind of look like a 1940s house. But the wallpaper was 196 pages of a petition from Portlanders to the city council and the city club. And it was saying, hey, do not let the Negroes live here. They're gonna take good jobs away from our Scandinavian brothers, and they're gonna cause our children to lose their inheritance, and they have this criminal element, and our wives won't be safe. Like, they literally, you know, put this information in political documents and created infrastructure within the state that would not allow us to be first-class citizens like everyone else. It kind of pivoted us to, those are the unnaturals, those are the predators, those are the criminals. And even in the state library, when you look at Black or Negro in Oregon, that language was associated with thug and criminal and jail. And so that was, you know, I can't get away from that. Intent is always built into policy, and we've never taken that intent out. Even before my nephew got killed in gun violence, when, you know, I was asking like, hey, what's going on out here for your children? What do they have, you know, to be involved in? And everybody was like, oh, the Boys and Girls Club and SEI. And I was like, oh, but those are like community policing partners. And they were like, yeah, if your kid hasn't been in trouble, then there's no resource for them. And I was like, wow. And then I would kind of investigate like numbers of people that were unaliving themselves, because my godson killed himself right after, you know, he graduated from high school. And again, those numbers represented people that lived in dire despair, you know, and poverty, and just no hope, you know, from the time that you're in school. And one of the reasons that I started advocating for families was that the children The way that the language appeared in the way that they were, captioning their behavior, it was always regulatory and authoritarian and kind of criminal. And so if we've been socialized to see Black people as a problem, and we've been socialized to ignore them and their needs to be fully accepted into society, then that's safe for those that would do that, and it's not safe for us. I can't undo that. I think that the only way that they can undo that is through a reparations process, because we can't catch up, not in my lifetime, not in my grandkids' lifetime. We're not going to catch up with being treated as everyone else in America is treated. Even when the word, when people started calling, communities of color POCs and stuff like that, it was like, we know the anti-Blackness that exists in our, in our lives, in our experiences. And we knew again that, oh, that's reparation language, except for the reparation is not for us. It's like, oh, okay, we're gonna help all these BIPOC groups and all these POC groups. And my son is like, Mom, there's people that are out there showing up, but I'm still not safe from them. If I'm walking down the street with someone that you just had tea with, that person is likely to cross the street if they see me and they don't know that I'm your son. They don't feel comfortable. And this is how he feels. This is his lived experience and so many others. We are treated as pariahs in society because there is a lack of investment and economic opportunity for us. And when there is an opportunity, people feel like they're losing something because we have access to something. And it might just be housing, healthcare, and education, but they feel like there's a loss. It might just be a job or, something like that. And they feel like they're giving us something that we didn't earn. And I can't take those feelings away from people, but I think that by reparating and not like a $2,200 a month check that's gonna, clearly just make ends meet, but I think there needs to be a firm reparations made throughout this country to Black people, and especially the descendants of slaves, enslaved people. We still, we can't catch up from being commoditized and now legally murdered and commoditized. And even when, George Floyd died, there were companies that benefited from his death, and they made promises to Black communities, and they didn't have to keep those promises after November.
I just wanted to go back to something you said towards the beginning of that response about the Liberated Archives Project. You mentioned the whole walls filled with these petitions from Portland residents to keep Black residents out of their neighborhood. And I remember we saw some of that, and it's just in the city archives. It's, government petitions that were made to the government sort of in the late 40s and 50s. And I think what I had seen was in the neighborhood sort of just south of where Emmanuel Hospital is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's thousands of signatures. And I'm just really curious what sort of the reaction has been to that Liberated Archives Project, and what sort of value that's had so far.
Yeah, well, for us, we have legal support. We do our artwork and then we pay legal fees, and we, try to help advocate for people that are being harmed by, state sanctioned policies that are set up to harm us. It's our way of fighting back. So when we did that, we did it in partnership with the city's records and management office. And my friend Mary Hansen had scanned those documents as a part of them digitizing the paperwork that they have. So I had so many different thoughts on different items that I had researched with them. And when I found this one, it kind of answered the question for me to tell people, because people are always like, why are y'all protesting? Why is race an issue? And they're making it sound like it's, such a condescending question when we live in this world and we know what's happening, to ask the person that's being harmed, what's wrong with you? And why do you bring this up? And so I felt that I would help people. And especially because during the time that we set that installation up, it had just, the previous year we had installation of protesters from over the years that we showed. So when we pulled this one in, it was basically to say, here's this information for you. And this was just in the 1940s. And these names look familiar. These streets are still there. These addresses are still available for you to go walk up to. And this is why people protest, because they're not wanted. And the reason that we have to protest is because since the state, after they allowed the petition, after the petition was granted, it took maybe, you know, a couple of years after that before it was retracted. But it was retracted because they figured out how to police us. They were like, okay, so then what are we going to do? Like, if we're going to have to let them be here, what are we going to do about it? And that's when, you know, Mr. Powell and all these other people got together and said, well, you know, we can have social services and health and aid, you know, and aiding systems. And what will happen is these people will be our dependents and we can get federal dollars from that. And we can just keep them in that system. We don't have to allow them to have jobs. And they didn't even have to write that we're not allowed to have jobs. It, at the time, they used to use the language of it was a gentleman's agreement. The same thing with real estate. We don't have to allow them to stay here, but we can pretty much pay for our homes and our businesses with their labor and with them paying into this. And so now we can own more because we have these people that can live in dilapidated housing and, you know, insecure situations, and that will cover the cost of my children's inheritance. And so having documents like that available and building those discussions and even having people that were alive and, you know, working for the city club or working for the auditor's office or for the city at that time, having them show up and share their thoughts and their memories about that, having people fill out the journal that we attached to the archives into the installation. Again, for me, it's evidence, because if you let us continue to say these things happen, and then you have people using that for kind of like entertainment purposes, it doesn't get us anywhere. But if you have families like the EPA too, the Emmanuel Displaced People's Movement, and then they can refer to documents like this and other policy mandates, I think that that's evidence of insidious maneuvering, you know? I hope that answered the question, but to me, it's always evidence and it's being shared for legal means. I think people need to fight back in whatever way that they're able to. But I think that having evidence to support their testimony is important.
I'm hearing that, you know, community education is a big piece of the work that you do, and you do that in multiple ways. We also know that you and your organization have been really involved in advocacy around a lot of the things that you've mentioned, right? So mental health, housing, education. You Don't Shoot PDX was also instrumental in bringing about a lawsuit that has exposed, you know, the notorious slide.
Mm-hmm. And much more.
Right.
People haven't even been able to see. I mean, between the lawsuit against the Trump administration and the federal agents that came out and doing that lawsuit so that we could see how many organizations and agencies here in the state connected with those orders and participated in that established violence. That's why, you know, obviously we didn't want people to be tear gassed. But at the same time, it was very important to see what those insidious partnerships look like. It was like, okay, who allowed this to happen and why, and where do they benefit? Because I think a lot of us saw the staging of, like, you know, I was about to say Donald Trump, but I meant Ted Wheeler. But a lot of us saw the staging that he did early in when the protest started, where he would have, you know, he'd be flanked with this group of people from the Black community that were like supporting him and everything else. And we've always talked about gatekeepers for generations. You hear activists, and especially in Black-led movements, talking about the sellouts and the gatekeepers in our communities. And when he was flanked with all these different people and they were denouncing the defund the police and they were denouncing the protests and really denouncing things that were to a direct benefit for the families and the communities that they represent, again, for me, that was evidence. It was like, oh, I hope people are paying attention to who's saying what and who's standing where. Because when we're all said and done with 2020, there's going to be a lot of reckoning And there's going to be a lot of reflection on words and actions. And, you know, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but.
No, you're good.
Like, oh, they're coming out the woodwork. And now we can just all watch it on Zoom and take notes and do our own research. And that's what I was hoping people would do, you know.
I'm thinking back to the times when, you know, some of the first times that I remember seeing you was testifying to city council in the famous, like, bridge crane testimony. And, then you've run for mayor. I'm wondering, as you've, through your years of working with this city in particular and the characters in it, if you've learned things that have caused you to change your approach to certain organizing practices or certain focuses for your work, has that evolved over time?
I don't trust people anymore. And that's evolved a lot because I remember, even in 2016, when we did the bridge crane testimony, we got assaulted by the police right after that. And every time we would get assaulted, even when Mike Brown was murdered and we, you know, had been kettled, no organizations that were with us would represent us in court. Like, they'd be like, yeah, you guys got kettled, but no one, you know, like, this is Oregon, and if we take you into a courtroom, people are not going to see you as, you know, people that deserve justice. They're going to think that whatever you did was unjustified because racism. And I was like, wow, that's messed up, but let's just try. And we couldn't get people that were courageous enough at the time to help us. Like, literally, people witnessed us being assaulted at City Hall after we provided testimony that day. They saw that, you know, ambulances would not support us. They wouldn't come to support us. They would not render care. We were told to stop protesting in order to get access to them, you know, for years. And I remember, you know, even before that, how, like, the three little Proud Boys would show up to our protests with their little signs. And I would ask our, you know, our friends and stuff and our allies, like, hey, don't engage with them. You're going to give them a platform, and we don't need to give them a platform. But their rage towards those people and their lack of consideration for us as Black leaders of a movement that, like, literally was centering our lives, was not enough reason for them not to engage. And so I watched this morphing of these people that literally were three dudes with a sign, you know, that would be talking about how Christ loves you and you shouldn't be gay and you shouldn't be Black and y'all should be just love and all this other Like, I watched those people become empowered because of, like, people that we considered allies. And I realized, you know, even when that stuff was happening, the response was that, well, you're doing it wrong. And it was like, how do we exist in this struggle when we're fighting for our lives? How do we do that right? How do we do, it's not us doing it wrong and engaging with people that would harm us and platforming, you know, isn't helping us. But I think that once I was able to remove myself from that situation and not be, you know, targeted as much, not get as many death threats, not have to worry about if my allies were really my allies or if they kind of, you know, like, if it was more important for them to be seen than for them to show up for our community, I think that everybody got to see what that looks like because we stayed together. Even if I got uncomfortable or felt that it was more of a risk, I think that people got to see what I was saying eventually, unfortunately, because it started happening to them and the people in their lives, and the people that were bystanders or, you know, spectators would see them as, now you're the bad person. You know, like, why are y'all out there talking to the Trumpers? Why are you doing this? And I was like, see, this is it. Like, that's, you know, like, that's racial hatred. Now y'all are like, you know, y'all are Black people lovers and people don't like Black, you know, people that show up for Black lives. And, you know, I don't know, it's such a disgusting situation that we find ourselves in that you can't articulate it enough that people have to experience it, unfortunately, for themselves. And that's kind of what has changed for me, is that I'm just allowing people to experience in their own time, because, you know, if I speak out, I'm a bad person or I'm not doing things right. I've been compared to, like, you know, people with college degrees. I grew up in foster care. Didn't nobody care about me. I was homeless until I had kids, and then I got Section 8, and then I got beat up. Like, I'm not going to – I didn't have time for a college degree or anything like that. But it doesn't mean that the people that have that and don't have my experience know more than me, you know? And so just the parallels of letting people see who people are, I don't know.
Don't Shoot did step in pretty significantly during the 2020 protests, especially in the legal arena, to, you know, push for that temporary restraining order on police use of chemical munitions, which they're, I mean, we saw how the loopholes in that were exploited pretty immediately, but mm-hmm. also recently the legislature rolled back some of the restrictions on the use of tear gas, and I'm just curious what is there a lesson that you take away from that whole 2 year long now legal struggle?
I testified on that, and I mean it's exactly what it is. Like, when there were large numbers of people showing up to protest in 2020 and 2016, the thing that you can see that is the same is that it was an election season. And so even the fact that the legislator adopted our ban initially was political, right? They wanted to be reelected. They wanted these funds. They wanted to get rid of Donald Trump. And so our state, you know, showed solidarity until November. And then you saw the numbers of people that were protesting dwindle. You saw the support going down. And one of the things that we did in addition to the lawsuit, because I already knew it was going to be seasonal, I was like, oh, this happens all the time. You know, we have people showing up, but they're not going to, you know, there's no way humanly, like it's impossible to continue doing this work constantly in the same way that you show up in you know, initially, because it is traumatic. And I knew that it was going to at some point kind of, you know, dwindle down. And so when we started instituting, like using our network to support the mutual aid efforts and also creating the RCA report, the report against the chemical agents that were being used, we were hoping that those would be long-term opportunities for people to continue fighting and to continue learning. And so, you know, not only the lawsuits, but the information that we used in order to develop the lawsuits, like that information was necessary, tangible, and available to people so that in whatever way that they felt comfortable, they could continue to move with us. The RCA report that we had published for the lawsuit was actually picked up by the Physicians for Human Rights Commission, and they've actually used it to get additional research and funding to kind of develop more focus on violence and police brutality in communities where they're fighting against racial movements that look, you know, seek equality. And so that's a big deal because they were able to use not only the interviews that they got during the protest and the information that was available to them through our published report, but they also interviewed us, and our board member, Dr. Anita Randolph, was the one of the chemists and neurologists that worked on that study for us. And, you know, that work is continuing to be done. So, you know, that all was intentional. It was like, okay, how do we get people to realize that the lawsuit is just a teeny piece, like not only getting all that discovery evidence, not only being able to look these fools in the eyes during their depositions and hear more about them and use that information to find out more about their biases. It's, you know, I don't want to say it's the gift that keeps giving because it hurt to receive it. But for us, you know, it was important to kind of exploit all of those different circumstances for the betterment of the movement work that people are doing.
So one of the pieces there that comes out loud and clear is the role of Don't Shoot PDX and groups like Don't Shoot PDX in generating resources that can then be used by the community in their own efforts to keep each other safe and to expand, like, their ability to fight these unjust systems and to fight racism and to fight city representatives and league and state representatives that would do them harm. I'm wondering if you still have any faith left in the city, in the city of Portland as an example, if you have any faith left in the city as an agent for harm reduction of Portlanders?
No, I don't have any faith in the city at all. Not at all. Not at all. Not any faith in the health department, not any faith in any of our federal agencies. I'm literally, you know, and that's sad because we have so many youth that are involved in movement work. But it's always been important to me that we look at these systems for what they are and that we don't wish them to be better, but that we identify what's going on with them and we dismantle them. You know, like my thought is that when we talk about smash the patriarchy, some people don't understand what that means. But if you show that there is evidence that it is a failing system and that it is contrived based on the amount of violence that it can pursue against people that it has already signaled to oppress, then maybe people will help us disestablish it. Maybe they'll help us burn it down, you know, and give the land back and, you know, liberate people that have been stolen and brought here. I think it all needs to fall off. And, you know, in the work that we do, we're trying to help people survive what that shattering looks like for all of us. And maybe if they're able to show that we can help each other enough to survive, that we won't be so afraid of not participating, if that makes sense. Like, you know, sometimes your participation, you find out later, like, oh, like I voted for somebody that was horrible. And it happened because so many elders in my community was like, we gotta ask somebody that looked like us in there. And this other person does not represent us. And I was like, well, I don't know. And they were like, please, you know, like we need a chance. And I did that. And I knew that no matter who we elected, it was gonna be a failing on our, you know, for our community. Nobody has the, you know, really the values that we have to, you know, like they won't get in there and do what they say they're going to do. Like I'm an anarchist. So let's say I got elected. I'm definitely going in there with audits and investigators to dismantle things that have been identified through, you know, history as anti-Black and really violently oppressive to people of color. But other people are like, well, I'm just going to fund this program so that we can learn how to do it better. You can't do that with violence. If you teach violence better, then you're going to obligate it to be legal, and it'll be a legal form of violence. And that's what we have. So I don't have any faith. Right now we're funding, you know, we're talking about funding more police. And, you know, we have, you know, like I said, they're throwing out $600,000. That's going to make communities even more sad. It's going to create more depression and more chaos and more division. And I think that the people that run the system, the leaders, they know that. And so, yeah, I don't have any faith in them. If we would have defunded our police or even made any kind of real attempt to do that, that would have gave me a little hope. But there were people that were like, defund the police, but give me the money, redirect the services to us, to us, to us. And I was like, hey, those are the same people that work with the police. If you give it to them, it's not going to be an obligation to do better. It's going to be an opportunity to do what they need to do until we stop protesting. So, yeah, no faith there.
What about the new Rethink Police Accountability Commission? Do you think that increasing accountability or the idea of increasing accountability has any legs at this point?
If we're not prosecuting them, if there's not a, what do you call it, a special legislator, if there's not a formalized process for indicting them and prosecuting them, then I don't believe that any kind of reform or rethinking or reimagining of police is going to work. I am a descendant of enslaved people, and I know that we didn't have police in the current form until we had emancipation of Black people. And the fact that we're trying to figure out how to make that like a new progressive situation is disgusting and horrible to me. I believe that we should be abolishing them, and I think that we should be pulling them out of society in whatever ways and means that we can. And I think that it would be possible if we used as much time initiating opportunities to propagate them and give them a platform. If we used all of that resource and time and energy and even capital to invest in communities that are deemed at risk, vulnerable, and marginalized, that we would actually have hope, because we would see that there was a intentional redirect, but there's not.
You mentioned a couple times the need to engage with and have, like, non-affiliated with the police programming for kids, young people, young adults. And you mentioned a couple things like Boys and Girls Club that are pretty explicitly partnered with the police and Portland Police Bureau specifically. So Don't Shoot Portland has some programs, a children's art and social justice youth council. Are there programs either within Don't Shoot or other elsewhere in the city that you would like to point to as good examples of non-police affiliated work?
Well, if they're not receiving funds from the state, then they're probably good, but I don't know too many organizations that don't ask for money in the form of grants and other ways from the same state that holds and oppresses us. Don't Shoot Portland, like, we really don't like money. We even, like, contacted investigators and attorneys when people were sharing our, you know, when people were soliciting on our behalf during 2020. They were like, oh, donate to Don't Shoot. We were like, fuck no, like, don't give us the money. This is blood money, because obviously we've been doing this Black Lives Matter movement work for a long time. And we know how insidious it is for families to see activists fundraising when their children die, right? I remember when Mike Brown's mom was like, these fools are out here like selling t-shirts with my baby's face on them. And we all saw Tamir Rice's mom say, these people have messed up our movement, because people saw the opportunities in doing the work because of the opportunities that were being made available to them by state actors, by, you know, policing partners and community organizations that were supported by police funneling dollars. And so that is, you know, it really hurts our movement, because this is a human rights and dignity movement. And I couldn't see any value coming from, you know, asking the person that's lynching me for some money. You know what I'm saying? Or saying, well, she got lynched. Like, if I take money from the lyncher, from the cop, then it's quite likely that I think that the person that they killed didn't matter. You know what I'm saying? And that maybe I can be more important than that person, or maybe my life is different than that person. They'll murder you too. You know, and taking their money makes them powerful, because they get to say that they have relationships with you and that they're partnered with you and that you work with them. I've advocated for families that are so traumatized by policing in our community that when their children are in court fighting for their lives for dumb stuff, stealing, you know, tapes or something, you know, dumb stuff, that they're like, I don't know what to do anymore, and I'm just going to let you make the decision. And they're saying this to, like, prosecutors, you know, because they don't know what else to do, and they are ashamed of what's going on because they have bared the burden of that shame. And I think that, you know, the best thing to do is to boycott those type of resources so that they're no longer available. And that, you know, to some people, they're like, you defund our program, like, when we do our audits. And it's like, because your program is done on the premise that you guys are good Black people and that you have to help these other Black people. And there's no premise that society is horrible and it treats people in this oppressive way. And there's no sanction against them doing that. So even though we're, you know, dressing our kids up in suits and having them have conversations with the police, that doesn't stop them from killing us. It doesn't, you know, at all. For instance, like Quanis Hayes was, you know, he used to be in the Boys and Girls Club since he was a little child. And the police officers that were on the scene, and even some that weren't on the scene, they all knew him through that program, and they knew him that day that they murdered him. And it didn't stop them. Aaron Campbell, Deontay Keller, all those same people, Kendra, you know, like, they know the people in our community because of community policing and these community partnerships for this, you know, relatable funding. And I kind of mentioned it when I was talking about that crime bill money. That money didn't include jobs and housing and education. It was for partnerships and referrals for policing. Mm-hmm. And that's what it does. I remember, and Kate Desmond from Multnomah County, after my brother's son got murdered, and I was like, hey, do you have any health and services for him or the other children in the family? Because, like, the kids want to unalive themselves and they're hurt and all these different things are happening, and my brother thinks he's a bad dad. And they were like, oh, he's unapproachable. We don't have anything for you. And I was like, really? I was like, but I've been watching 70 agencies sit around this table, including TriMed and the Portland Public Schools and all these pastors and stuff. And they're being paid. They're getting grants. You guys are talking about money all the time. And you don't have health and grieving services for Black people that lose their children in gun violence. Like, that's incredible that that wouldn't be a part of your infrastructure for supporting us. So, yeah, I think it undermines the value of liberation when you have those type of funds. And I don't know too many groups that exist that don't take those funds.
I think about that lack of support when it comes to families who have lost their loved ones to police violence. Mm-hmm. As well, I'm wondering, we've talked about that police violence, that white supremacist violence that's inherent to the state and to its actors. I wonder how you are feeling about the white supremacist violence that we're seeing within our communities. To me, it seems like it's increasing, but I don't know if that is my perception or if that is just me noticing.
I think it's just noticing. A lot of people did not even want to hear about racialized violence, until I think the Max murders and the death of Larnell Bruce, those things happened so connected in such a small amount of time. But even before they were murdered, we had been working with, like, my friend Sean and all these other people to kind of advocate and tell people about these different symbols and images that were happening, because so many people, because of Don't Shoot Portland being a community organizer, a group of community organizers working together, the first thing we noticed when we were protesting for Mike Brown was that you cannot safely get home because people were attacking you for being out there for this kid that everybody thought should have died, and neighbors didn't agree with you, and families stopped having discussions. And so it became a real challenge for us to educate people on how to find resources to help them kind of like identify areas where it wasn't safe, or identify like badges or, you know, tags on walls and things that exist in our community where we knew that there was a heightened, violence indicator or whatever you want to call it. Even when Larnell was murdered, the police were not going to, you know, prosecute a hate crime until we had to let them know, like, hey, didn't you see in your newscast and didn't you see on the scene of the crime that there was an EK on that hat? It's European Kindred. That's a racist organization. And, you know, this person, you know, he teaches people in jail and works on recruiting. And they were like, how do you know this? And I think, like, you know, after a while, they realized it, like, oh, yeah, Russell's been, you know, arrested over 40 times for violent offenses against different people, including women. And, you know, like, he might be a bad guy. And then, you know, more intel came in where it was like, oh, yeah, he does, like, recruit in the jails and all this. So, you know, maybe that European Kindred is a thing, you know. And it was like, you don't know that. You know everything about the Black community. And you don't know anything about all of these white Aryan racist, white nationalists and right wing groups that are here in Oregon. Like, I think we didn't see it because it didn't affect us. And I think that when we started building community through our organizing, that it became something that did affect us because we became closer. We didn't just know Black people. We were out there sacrificing our lives on the front line with each other. And so we loved each other, and that made us more aware.
We wanted to ask what some of the priorities are for both for you and for Don't Shoot PDX for future work, both short-term and long-term.
Well, for us, it's mostly to continue engaging and educating people on what their role is in regards to the power that they hold to deal with civic engagement. There's some people that still want to use that measure to connect and disconnect, and I'm hoping that they do it intentionally. So right now we have an art installation at Holding Contemporary that's focused on white supremacy, and on one side it has like all these racist faces, and it's like a Tupac song in the middle, and then there are these archival documents that we hope that being in that space and being immersed with all the information, that it creates an opportunity for people to start doing more researching, and not only doing the research, but using different mediums to share that research so that we all become aware. Because just like what I just said in that last answer, that once we were connected as Community Action Plan, you know, we were all together on the streets, that made us care more about each other as humans, and it kind of changed how we formulated our roles in society. And I think the more evidence, the more lawsuits, the more, you know, art installations, the more protests, the more, you know, indictable opportunities that we get, the further along we'll be. And hopefully our, you know, the next generation will have something that is useful to them to continue doing this work of dismantling America. But it has to be done. I don't think that America should ever, you know, be great. I don't think that it ever has been. And I think that we need to dig out that evidence so that we can kind of help it deteriorate and become what our indigenous guardians of this place would like it to be. And I don't think that they'll kick all of us out. I just think that the values that we exhibit as a country need to be centered around indigenous, you know, lives and love, and the way that we were meant as stewards of the world to take care of each other. I think that we're just a violent nation. So I'm just gonna continue, like right now I'm getting older, obviously I'm getting gray hair, I'm a grandma, and that's a really important role for me to play in my life, because I don't want my grandchildren to have to inherit what we have currently. So I'll continue using art and education and community organizing to fight these legal battles. And that's pretty much what we do. We do our art installations. We use the money that we get from art installations and we put it back into the legal system to help people, you know, liberate us. And so that's what we're gonna continue doing.
We definitely have, as Portlanders, have been benefiting for many years from your work and your dedication to your community. So definitely a big thank you to you on that and your group. I don't want to trivialize it, but I am curious, are you going to run for mayor again? Can we count on that?
No, it was such a humiliating task. And for me, it was incredible to watch how, you know, right before George Floyd's murder, I remember for 4 weeks being in court with the families that, you know, lost their loved ones on the MAX train, and seeing that there was not a mumble, you know, like people really weren't responding or showing up for them. And then right after we prosecuted Jeremy and he got sentenced, like it seemed like that same week George Floyd was murdered and so many people showed up. And it was incredible because people thought that while I was running that I wasn't trying hard enough, but people literally did not value me as a candidate or as a person. And they showed me that in so many damn ways that I would never put myself in that position again. I was doing that out of love, not ego, because I was like, we can do this, y'all. Like, if we've been together this long, this consistent, and we have the partnerships that we have. We got the Ashley Albies and, you know, all these different amazing attorneys, and all of our legal observers are now lawyers. you know, from 2014 when Juan and everybody was, you know, first and second year law school, now they're all really competent civil rights attorneys. My thought was that that was the best thing that we could do to, you know, really, really make a foundation for future generations. And I don't know too many people that are willing to do what I was willing to do in that position. And because of the response, like it was humiliating. It was sad. And racism played a lot of a lot in that. And I put myself through that pain again, because I would probably, you know, I want to say it here, but I wouldn't exist anymore. It was the most horrible experience ever. I think I had more fun when people were running me for sheriff than I did, you know, really considering and running and putting my whole heart into running for mayor. And the fact that I was able to be treated that way, I got enough, you know. It was for our community, and obviously they didn't want me, so I will never put us through that again. I feel, you know.
I'm really sorry to hear that it was such a humiliating experience for you. I definitely appreciated you being your candidacy, and without revealing too much about our political leanings, I definitely wrote you in for mayor. So I appreciate you, Teresa.
No, I love our community. I just will never put us, I won't do that again. You know, I hope that other people will do what they need to do, but I hope they don't do it to fit in. I hope they do it to smash the patriarchy. I hope they get in there to bend everything in a different direction and not just to learn how to run the city, because running the city, it's already, it, you know, that thing is operational, but we have to make it inoperable. And I really appreciate y'all, because, you know, you wouldn't be interviewing me if you didn't show up and know what this work is about. And I know that that trauma is a shared trauma, but we're doing the right thing. And I always want people to know that, you know, that you're showing up and that you're caring about us, that matters. Like, our community sees that and they know it, and they feel safer in our city than they ever did. Even with all the uprising and violence, people know that we got people.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And thank you so much for talking with us again. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, absolutely. Thank y'all. And you have a good weekend.
You too.